This is Monday, August 5th, 2002, 10 a.m. in the State Capitol Room 357. It's the meeting of the House Interim Work Group on Public Contracting Law, chaired by Representative Bill Garrard.
Oh, yeah. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the meeting of the House Interim Work Group on Public Contracting Law. We will be kind of catching ourselves up to date a little bit first off this morning because of the fact that we have not met for a while due to three special sessions, and hopefully we can go forward now in the next 60 to 90 days to conclude what we've started off to do here. We'll have a report basically that subchapter A on 279 is near completion. That's the purchasing portion of 279. Subchapter B, the public improvement area, is an area that we're still working on, and we're going to need the involvement of all of you to reach a conclusion. But it certainly is the intent of this committee to have some draft legislation done and move it forward before the next session of the legislature. At this point, to review the rewrite process, I'll ask any committee member like to make a statement. Or okay, Representative Backlund and Representative Canope are here, so I'll ask for Dugan Petty to come forward and give us a report on the ORS 279 rewrite process. Good morning, Dugan.
Good morning, Representative Girard, members of the committee. My name for the record is Dugan Petty. I'm the Deputy Administrator with Transportation Purchasing and Print Services Division in the Department of Administrative Services. And I have with me today Bill Nestle, the Assistant Attorney General, who is the chair of the ORS 279 Drafting Committee team, who is working on the actual drafting of the work. I'm here today on behalf of two co-chairs who are not with us. One, Sue Klobertanz, who has had a long scheduled family vacation that she's now resuming in Black Butte, as I understand it, so she won't be here today. And Jessica Harris, who will be joining us sometime this morning, who's flying in from Las Vegas fresh from a wedding. I promised to spread the rumor that it was her wedding, but it really isn't. So she'll be joining us, and we'll be talking in more detail about what's happened on the what we call the B side, or 279B, which is the section that deals primarily with public improvement contracting. If I might kind of in an overall sense say that probably in closeness to the finish line, I think the 279B side was kind of lagging, but they've now surged ahead. If you think about this soapbox derby hill we have behind us a mile or so away, they got a later start, but now they've kind of moved ahead, and they're probably three-quarters or better to the way to the finish line. And some of it is by the nature of what they're really attempting to do. And I would say that on a general sense that the A side is probably close to 60% down that hill. But the good news is that what's left, I think, should go pretty fast. So today I'd like to give you an update of our progress and really talk about what we've accomplished, how we've organized ourselves since the first meeting we've had on January 10th. And then after we've talked about that, we'll go into a little more detail about what's contained in the revisions that we've made on the A side to date, and Bill will assist and go through that description. You have in front of you a packet that probably looks something like this. It's a report to the work group. It's about 10 pages without the markup on it. And I'd just like to take a minute to kind of organize that in your mind so you can follow through that as we talk about it today. On page 10, I draw your attention to the attachments, and they are in order. The first attachment is the charge in expectation that we discussed in the group, which I believe captures the work group's charge to the task group for carrying out this rewrite effort. The second attachment is called guiding principles. Now, these are principles that we have agreed to that we will govern the rewrite effort. Those have been modified a couple of times as we went along to get it to get them straight in everybody's mind. We have a document called the Working Structure and Process, and I think Kara Filsinger has a diagram that really sort of graphically depicts this working structure, and I'll go over that later on in the discussion. You have the ground rules, which are simply kind of the rules of the road that we play by as we meet in committee. And then the format flow for Chapter 279, that's this kind of conceptual flow diagram, which should not be the first time you've seen this. I believe that this was present in your first committee meeting, your first work group meeting, and it is really the kind of the conceptual schematic that we've attempted to follow in this rewrite effort, although you'll see that it's been modified somewhat. And then finally, the last five attachments are substantive revisions to ORS 279, two of them Article 3 and Article 4, which will be articles within general procurement section of 279, and then three attachments that come from the public improvement, the 279B side, which should kind of have the whole layout of the different provisions in 279, and then A&E as well as exemptions to key portions of the 279B part. Jessica will be talking about those later on in the hearing. So to start off with, on January 10th, we had our first meeting, and we really accomplished quite a lot in terms of setting up our organizational structure, how we would make decisions, and we reached a couple of very key decisions. The first thing I want to talk about in that was we agreed to reach consensus on charge and expectation. And the goal in the charge and expectation, which is our understanding of your charge to us, is to replace ORS 279 with an effective, simplified procurement code developed in collaboration with stakeholders during the 2003 legislative session. And there were some specific expectations. They're short, and I'll read them just quickly. To involve all interested stakeholders in dialogue and rewrite, to utilize a collaborative process to achieve consensus supporting the revised recommendations, to apply brainstorming, derived concepts where appropriate. Those were kind of this kickoff brainstorming session that preceded your first meeting where people looked at the existing statute and said, here are the things that we think need to be fixed. Here's what's not working, or here are some things we ought to pull into it. To develop a legislative concept draft that provides an Indian procurement code for Oregon public agencies and submit as a recommendation to the legislative work group chaired by Representative Girard by December 1st of 2002. And then finally, to provide progress reports and recommendations to the legislative work group as we make progress. So this will be our first progress report. We reached some guiding principles. I'll hit some of the highlights of those guiding principles. They're to strive to simplify the process and policy so it can be easily understood, to standardize processes except where procurement outcomes are compromised, and this is one that really embodies a key understanding that we reached in the first meeting, and it's to separate public works construction from other procurement activities by creating two subchapters in ORS 279, to make changes to the general procurements as a priority, and to make substantive changes to the 279 or the public improvement side only as full consensus permits. And this is based on an understanding that there is a lot of agreement and compromise, frankly, that's represented in the public improvement statutes. And it is practically not reasonable to think about completely revising those. And there isn't the will or the agreement around that to make much in the way of substantive change in 279B or the public improvement side. So by separating these two, it allows a revision on the 279A side through a consensus process, and if we can't reach consensus, to move to a majority vote, and it allows some more out-of-the-box thinking on the 279A side or the general procurement side, while it preserves the basic tenets that are currently in statute as it relates to public improvement. Now, Jessica later on will talk about some changes where the 279B side is actually recommending some changes, but these changes have been made with full consensus of the group, and as a result, they're fairly minor. If you will turn to page 2 of the report, there's a little diagram here that really represents graphically the decision that we reached in this first meeting, which is really the key decision to move forward in this group. And it has a lot to do with how we've reorganized or organized ourselves around decision making within these two sections. We would envision the rewrite to be made up of ORS Chapter 279, with general provisions that apply to all contracting practices, policy statement, definitions that can apply to both, a method of determining whether procurement should be under general procurement or it should be under public improvement procurements. And then we would also like to move up into the regular 279 chapter, the overarching chapter, any provisions that are relative to both sides of the procurement. In other words, there are some provisions like general policy. I think the contracting preference for recycled products that have applicability as they're currently written to both general procurements, which would be conducted under this 279A side, as well as public improvements, which would be conducted on the B side. 279A would be comprised of all general procurement activity that does not involve public improvement or construction, as we think of it. 279B will involve public improvement, construction, highway, buildings, architectural and engineering services, and related architectural and engineering services. So this kind of breaks that out. And as a result, what's happened in the work process is we've convened committees around these two different topic areas. B has had a committee that has been largely homogeneous meeting to go through and reorganize, pull out all of the existing provisions of 279 and reorganize them in a Part B section. And then they've broken into subgroups, which is largely the same people who have worked on those different subgroups and reported back. On the A side, we started more with a clean sheet of paper. We borrowed heavily from the ABA Model Procurement Code. We looked at other best practices. We looked at DOJ model rules. We looked at other jurisdiction rules. And we looked at existing statute. And the first subcommittees that we broke into were methods of source selection, which was really borrowed from the Model Procurement Code and is consistent with that organizational flow diagram that we've shared with you. And that really sets out how we what are the methods that we go through for public acquisition? What are those different processes? We had an alternative source selection committee, which kind of looked at the area of exemption, and those coalesced into that Article 3 methods of source selection. We had a specification group. We've had a legal remedies group, which is still meeting, coming up with protests and appeal procedures for the general procurement side, trying to really gather up all the appeal-related provisions that exist in current statute or ought to exist in current statute and put them in one place so both suppliers and public agencies can go to one place to understand how the appeal process works. We have a group which is convened around client and provider services to ask the question if there should be a different way that we do client-provider services under statute. Currently, it's simply hit as a professional or personal services contract, not a lot of specificity there, and frankly, it's a bit like putting a square peg in a round hole for that kind of process. We've had a specification group that borrowed largely from the Model Procurement Code article on specifications and has come back with recommendations that incorporate some provisions of existing statute and I think break some new ground upon the idea of how a supplier ought to be able to engage in the early stages of developing specification and at what point specifications are the responsibility of the public agency to make sure that they aren't unduly restrictive in some way. We wrestle long and hard with that. We have some examples of our neighboring state to the south where provisions there have not been been as clean as they might be, and it's caused some problems. So we think we've made some improvement in the area of specifications. Let me talk a little bit about the working structure that we have identified, and I think Kara's diagram would be very helpful to look at. We have an A side, which is looking at the general procurement issues, and then we have a B side. Both of these groups meet at least weekly. The task group, which we roll up to, meets at least monthly, and now we are into the period of time where we think we'll be meeting at least twice a month as we come down to that finish line. And we have a drafting team. The drafting team, chaired by Mr. Nestle, has Doug McKean on it, representing the Legislative Council, and other procurement managers, representing from the Association of Oregon Counties, who take the product, which comes out of a topic group convened by the task group. The topic group will recommend to the task group its recommendations. Large task group meets on that, goes through them, makes changes, and then passes that document on to the drafting team. The drafting team then refines it, sends it back to the task group. Task group reaches consensus, and then it's forwarded on to the work group. The drafting team is charged with not only getting these initial articles ready to pass on to the work group, but also, once they've got them as polished as they can be, to kind of put them on the shelf for now and wait for the other articles to catch up with it. At some point, when we get all the articles in file and completed, then that drafting team will have the job of kind of knitting them together in one whole concept. Because Legislative Council is working on the drafting team, I think we have a very good working relationship, which will make it easier, I think, for Legislative Council when they do receive all the parts of this to knit it together into a whole piece of legislation that can be a whole procurement law replacement. So I think I've talked about kind of an overview of how we're structured. We have various topic groups that are convened largely around the articles that we've put into the format flowchart. As topics or questions pop up, we have convened issue-related groups to look at those and report back. We've talked about some key understandings about breaking this chapter down into a 279A and a 279B side with some general provisions, which would be the overarching 279 provisions. And I think at this point, it's probably reasonable to begin to talk about substantively what we've done on the 279A side to give you an overview of these two articles. Before I do that, just let's pause here for a moment to see if there are any questions about how we're structured or anything about what we've done so far in terms of operations or decision making.
Any questions from any of the committee members? We'd like to welcome Representative Barnhart and Representative Nolan. Good morning. Duke and I had one question in regards to A. I believe it's pretty well been understood that we're going to continue the exemption for education, and I know that's been of concern to some groups.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned that we had made some revisions in guiding principles as we went along to make sure that it reflect the consensus of the group. The last change that really incorporates that is our 12th guiding principle, and it says revisions and rewrite of this chapter based on the assumption that independent purchasing authorities of state agencies and boards as codified in ORS 279 or other enabling legislation will be preserved in the reorganized chapter. So we're not proposing as a part of this 279 rewrite to make any substantive shifts in existing purchasing authorities, but to simply try and pull what exists right now together in some way that people can understand how the status quo actually is, and leave that alone. So with respect to the Oregon University system, who currently are not covered under ORS 279, it is not the intention of this group to recommend a change in that area. Those are, of course, policy prerogatives that the legislature has. And since we're into this area, it's worth saying that we think as we come through this at the end, that we actually may flag some potential policy questions that you may want to look at or consider that would be separate from the rewrite effort. I'll give you another case in point. Currently, the sections that guide recycled products or recyclable products are fairly old. They were written 10 to 15 years ago. Certainly, that whole business from the government side, as well as what's available from the supplier side, has changed substantially. We now think of that more in the context of sustainability. There were some discussions about whether there should be more sustainability criteria built into this. And since those really raise major policy issues, we've decided not to have those as any part of the rewrite. But if there are suggestions in that area, they would come in as separate flag policy questions for you to consider. We may tune up some of that recycled product preference in a way that reflects it today, but without really trying to disturb any of the major policy shifts. So those are a couple of examples where we will not be recommending a major policy shift.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you. Dugan, you mentioned the recycling and section. Does that include, or would it include, used furniture systems, that sort of thing?
It does not address refurbishment of furniture per se. It talks about recycling and percentages of recycled content for areas such as paper and recycled products. So it doesn't talk about that per se. There may be some, I'd have to go back and look at that, there may be some room for discussion about this notion of purchasing recycled workstations, for example. But I don't think it has anything, there's nothing directly aimed at that. There's a lot of discussion of recycled oil, paper, and then recycled products in general. But there are no classifications that I'm aware of that talk about furniture with respect to recycled content.
Should there be? Refurbished or used products or whatever it is we're talking about here doesn't seem to quite fit the recycling.
Yeah, I think that's a good question, and I think that's a good policy discussion to have. I know a couple of years ago, a bill came up to attempt to provide a preference for recycled construction material, and there was really nothing within current statute that incorporated that notion into how you buy construction products, and that did not pass out of the legislature. But I think we are seeing more and more of that, and I know that currently we are, I think Diane Lancaster's group is in fact crafting a procurement and has been working on that for about a month or two to put together a workstation bid so that we are bringing about recycled products. So some of that can happen without any change in statute. I mean, I think she'll have great success with that without revision to statute.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I was remiss, by the way, Mr. Petty, before you began, and not thanking the work group leaders for their efforts and the Department of Justice staff that's been involved. This has been a very well collaborated effort, and this committee appreciates the effort that has been put forth by everybody so far.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think you'd be gratified to see that each month there are probably somewhere between 20 and 30 people who tirelessly come to these meetings. I know Representative Barnhart, Representative Nolan have visited some of the sessions, and we meet from 9 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon, and we're real good about getting off right at 4 o'clock. But we go all day, and we have worked through some of these provisions with spirited discussion, and people have been at the table and they have been engaged, and there are also topic groups that are meeting at least weekly on these topics and wrestling with some pretty tough areas. So the success that we've had in making progress is really due in large part to those 30 or so folks who have been really engaged in this process. And I think their reason for engagement is because they really know that this needs to be done.
Good.
Thank you.
And you may continue.
Well, with that, let's talk a little bit about the substantive changes that you see represented in front of you in Article A and 279A, Article 3, and Article 4. You may ask, why are we starting with Article 3 and moving to Article 4? We intentionally wanted to avoid starting with a general procurement area or definitions area because that really forces you to kind of deal with the whole, to eat the whole thing all at once, and we would rather circle back around on some of those. So we started with methods of source selection, which really turns out to be, if you think about it, the core fundamental piece of any procurement code related to how the public should expend, or related to how a public agency should expend its public dollars. And that one section, as it turned out, encompassed methods of, not only methods of source selection, but contract formation. It encompassed advertising. It encompassed alternative source selection, contract formation, advertising, and source selection. So with that one fell swoop, that one article, which is fairly lengthy, Article 3, involves those four articles. So we took out quite a few in this conceptual flow diagram. As I said, it represents, I think, the kind of the core foundation because it provides really a cookbook that's understandable by suppliers as well as public agencies about how public procurement will be done. And it identifies the primary methods of source selection which a public agency must use when they're acquiring goods or services for the public entity. Now, it has a bias built into it, and we modeled this after the model procurement code. Its format is largely after the model procurement code, which says that sort of the policy is that all procurements will be done through a competitive sealed bid or a competitive sealed proposal unless they are done by some other methodology. And it identifies some specific methodologies in which the public agency must either do a determination to do something other than a bid or a proposal. I think it provides accountability. It provides process detail to both the suppliers and the public agencies. And it kind of untangles it and provides some simplified ways of conducting business. And with that, let me pass it over to Bill Nestle, and he can go through that in a bit more detail.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bill Nestle with the Department of Justice. I've had the privilege of being able to chair the drafting committee. That sounds pretty fancy, but basically that committee is really just the super recording secretary of this group, and we try to put together all the ideas, polish them against the existing statutes and against the existing case law, and try to incorporate this into something that we can turn over proudly to legislative council to be placed in the conventions that are necessary for statutes. The source selection article contains one small shift in policy. You may recall that back prior to 1993, virtually all of the first part of ORS Chapter 279, which governs the letting of public contracts, was pretty much construction-oriented and based on what we tend to call strict or straight bidding, which means that you issue invitations to bid, and by statute, the award must go to the lowest responsible bidder. In other words, so long as you determine that the bidder has the wherewithal to faithfully perform the contract, the lowest price wins. As things have evolved, of course, we have a new technology, and sometimes you want to examine the qualifications, the experience, and maybe even the technical features of the product that is offered, such as an information system, and roll that into your scoring because you don't always get the optimum bargain for the public with the lowest price. You may recall the famous John Glenn quote when he was being launched into space and saying, you know, all I could think was that here my life depends on something that was produced by the lowest bidder. And so in 1993, the legislature enacted a few laws that talked about alternative means of establishing public contracts. And to the core provision in the public contracting law, which originally stated, unless given a particular exemption, all public contracts shall be based on competitive bids, they added two words and stated all public contracts shall be based upon competitive bids or proposals. But they didn't change anything else in the law, so we were faced with a situation where we had much governance of formal strict bids, but nothing to guide public procurement officers on both the state and the local government levels on how to handle proposals where they wanted to judge contractor qualifications, expertise, and the quality of products and roll that into the selection criteria. So most public contracting agencies had to go to their public contract review boards and set up an entire new exemption process for proposals, excuse me. Now, under this draft, what we propose to do is to make a general default rule that gives equal status to bids and to proposals and states that the general rule, the ultimate default provision, is going to be that public agencies will award their contracts based on bids or proposals. And then instead of having simply a law that governs bids, we have two separate sections, one that governs the letting of contracts under bids, one that governs the letting of contracts under requests for proposals, and each of those sections you issue invitations to bid, and by statute, the award must go to the lowest responsible bidder. In other words, so long as you determine that the bidder has the wherewithal to faithfully perform the contract, the lowest price wins. As things have evolved, of course, we have a new technology, and sometimes you want to examine the qualifications, the experience, and maybe even the technical features of the product that is offered, such as an information system, and roll that into your scoring, because you don't always get the optimum bargain for the public with the lowest price. You may recall the famous John Glenn quote when he was being launched into space and saying, you know, all I could think was that here my life depends on something that was produced by the lowest bidder. And so in 1993, the legislature enacted a few laws that talked about alternative means of establishing public contracts. And to the core provision in the public contracting law, which originally stated, unless given a particular exemption, all public contracts shall be based on competitive bids, they added two words and stated all public contracts shall be based upon competitive bids or proposals. But they didn't change anything else in the law, so we were faced with a situation where we had much governance of formal strict bids, but nothing to guide public procurement officers on both the state and the local government levels on how to handle proposals where they wanted to judge contractor qualifications, expertise, and the quality of products and roll that into the selection criteria. So most public contracting agencies had to go to their public contract review boards and set up an entire new exemption process for proposals, excuse me. Now, under this draft, what we propose to do is to make a general default rule that gives equal status to bids and to proposals and states that the general rule, the ultimate default provision, is going to be that public agencies will award their contracts based on bids or proposals. And then instead of having simply a law that governs bids, we have two separate sections, one that governs the letting of contracts under bids, one that governs the letting of contracts under requests for proposals. And each of those sections, these are sections 3202 and 3203 in your handout, contain a rather extensive cradle to contract award recipe that we think the public contracting officers can use and go down as a general checklist to make sure they've covered all the bases and lawfully and fairly let a contract under each of those two procedures. That's the first major step. In addition to that, the working group has proposed some alternative means of letting public contracts. The first two of these, one of them is in section 3204, is for small procurements. And what that indicates is that local public agencies may establish their own contracting rules to establish contracts with a value of $5,000 or less. The $5,000 figure is based on an existing statute that exempts now from the requirements of bids and proposals public contracts for services, supplies, and equipment that are under $5,000. So we haven't really changed the policy. There's a little bit more breadth in what public agencies might purchase under the draft, because it's not restricted to services, supplies, and equipment. But nevertheless, we are hewing to the pre-established legislative policy that's in the current law. A secondary and intermediate procurement system is found in Section 305 of this draft. And this, like the small procurement section, is basically intended for the somewhat lesser value, less complex procurements where you don't want to spend almost as much money on your system for buying the thing as you do on the thing itself. And so we've carved out a procurement system for contracts that run in the range between $5,000 in value and $75,000 in value, in which the contracting agencies are required to solicit or to attempt to solicit three competitive quotes to create a public record of the quotes received and then to award on that basis. And once you move above the $75,000 threshold, then it's your general rule that you use bids or proposals. In addition, there are a couple of important things that are already found in the existing law. There's the ability to go with a sole source procurement when there is only one available supplier of something that a public contracting agency needs, and also emergency procurements. I don't have to avert too much to things like the slides we had on Highway 101 last winter and the need to get equipment out there and get the road reopened. And that is a feature of the current law, and we decided to retain it in a slightly modified form in the public contracting law that we're proposing today. And finally, there is what we call special procurements in Section 3.208. And what this is a counterpart to the existing law, which allows public contract review boards at the local level and the director of the Oregon Department of Administrative Services at the state level to make particular findings and allow a procurement to be made outside the normal structures. And we've retained essentially the same findings in this system that you have under the current law, with a couple of special provisions. First of all, as in the current law, you cannot grant one of these exemptions unless you make a determination that going this different route, and we leave that open because we allow agencies under these exemptions to structure their own contract award system. But they must make the finding that doing it in that manner will not have a substantial adverse impact on competition for public contracts or tend to encourage favoritism in the awarding of public contracts. And that's pretty much the language that we have in ORS 279.015 sub 2 as we sit here today. The second necessary finding is a little bit different. Under the current law, the agency, in order to take an alternate route to a procurement, also has to find that taking that particular route will result in substantial cost savings to the public agency. And although that's important, the legislature has recognized in the recent emergency bridge legislation that there can also be very significant savings to the general public that the agency doesn't directly enjoy. And we'd like to put that figure and propose to put that figure. So if you're saving trucking companies from having to reroute by getting a fast contract on a specialized basis, we ought to be able to recognize that and take care of the constituents as well as just the public agency's contracting budget. And then finally, we have a residual clause for special opportunities in which the public agency can also justify a procurement if there is a special public interest to be realized that cannot practically be interest by using one of these panoply of basic contracting schemes. And that's the basic contracting format that we are offering here today. I have to remind you that what we're looking at only involves the acquisition of goods and services. We are keeping this entire section away from the public improvements whatsoever. The only area that has been retained is something that in the current law has also been taken out of public improvements, and that is a section that permits ordinary maintenance activities that are necessary to preserve an existing public improvement. That is currently accepted from the definition of public improvement in the current law, and we thought it would be appropriate to manage that on the general goods and services side. We've attempted to define goods and services in a way that's broad enough that public agencies can buy anything they need other than public improvements, and that was quite a challenge. We spent more time on the definitions than we'd like to admit, because it's very difficult to make a one-size-fits-all procurement system. And the models we were looking at, like the model procurement code, were based essentially on a state system. And here in Oregon, I think we have to recognize the autonomy of local governments. And so we do have a system here that is based on the concept of the public contracting agency. And we don't have a centralized governance in Oregon. In fact, as you know, we even delegate the authority to grant exemptions to a local public contract review board, whereas back in 1977, when I was a Cub, there was one state contract review board that sat here in Salem, and everybody who had a special problem had to come there and meet their schedule in order to get an exemption. But the goods and services, excuse me for getting sidetracked, is defined as meaning supplies, equipment, materials, and services other than personal services designated by the agencies under statutory authority in 279, and includes any personal property, including tangible, intangible, intellectual property, and rights and licenses in relation thereto. We think that's an important addition because we find that, heck, I can't even buy a car that anymore that doesn't have some software in it and a software license. And you can imagine that the technical systems that we're buying these days have the same thing. So we wanted to be able to wrap up authority to purchase all the rights that a local or state agency might need to have in order to be able to use an item of equipment, a special product, or a special system. We also included in goods and services combinations of any of the items identified above, and that's designed to embrace the combinations that we encounter, which frequently include you get an item of equipment, you might get a maintenance contract, which is services, and we don't want to get in trouble for picking the wrong procurement system and arguably having an invalid contract. And then, as I adverted to earlier, we also state that it includes emergency work, minor alteration, and ordinary repair or maintenance necessary in order to preserve an public improvement, so we can take care of the maintenance of what we already have in terms of real property improvements. And so that's the general design. That is the breadth and scope of this particular article, and those are the general ground rules on how we propose to govern agencies' procurements. I'd be very willing to move into a subsection-by-subsection analysis of perhaps the major invitation to bid and RFP. It's a little bit in-depth, and those are long sections, but I think now might be a good time to break and take questions if you have any.
Representative Nolan.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I'm not sure whether this question is best addressed to you or to I don't see Sue Klobuchar here, but someone representing the local governments. My question is whether they could accommodate administratively an indexing of the dollar amounts you are proposing in here so that we can not have to go through, so that it keeps up with the kinds of purchases that they're making.
Well, Representative Nolan, we do have some local government representatives here, so maybe Fran or one of them would be happy to address that. I would take a shot at it. I don't want to talk for Sue, but I think we all have that issue of indexing because it is a practical reality that we have today. And for the most part, this pretty much models what we currently have in place. I mean, for example, on the state side, under 5,000, we have a rule that talks about it, but it feeds back to the provision in statute. By rule and class exemption, we have created this, what is effectively this intermediate procurement tier where you're obliged to get three quotations, but it's a little bit less formalized than the full competitive bid limit. So my sense is that we haven't heard, at least in the task group, local government saying, oh, wait a minute, that's a problem.
quick follow-up, Mr. Chair, while you're looking around? And I don't need a specific answer. I think I know the answer to my question. Having been on the local government purchasing side of this, I appreciate that you're trying to mirror existing law and not propose policy changes like that other than within the charge that we gave you.
Mm-hmm.
Can you help us remember how long that $5,000 threshold has been in statute and how long the $5,000 to $75,000 window has been in statute and rule? Mr. Nestle looks like he has an answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I can't remember when it was not, and that goes back to 1977.
Well, and that accomplishes the same objective that I'm trying to make. $5,000 doesn't buy you much, and I think the point you made, Mr. Petty, about how much money local purchasing agents are spending jumping through hoops,
yes,
is something we need to be mindful of. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nolan, I think that's a terrific comment. We have felt a little bit nervous about how far we might push that. I would give you another rewrite that I've kind of followed over the years was the Federal Acquisition Reform Act of 1994. And they, in particular, attempted to reorganize what was a very cumbersome, paper-heavy process to free up the government to be more efficient yet accountable. And they took their small procurement limit up to $100,000. But they did that with a caveat that they wanted them to use an electronic system so they could at least see where those expenditures are being made. I think if we were to look at where Oregon sits in that continuum of how much has been the lower end of the threshold been freed up from that process, I think you would find, at least from a state to state, I'm not talking local, that Oregon is probably in the top percentile with some of the highest levels of thresholds. Other states, 50,000, 25,000, in which they put out a formal competitive bid. So the group there wasn't a lot of push that we heard from the group to extend that quote threshold above 75,000. John is with local government, so you may want to.
John Oshel, Association of Oregon Counties. To answer Representative Nolan's question, and it really is a two-part answer, that probably the second part is more important than the first part. Local governments generally have been supportive of trying to index as many of these numbers we could, whether it be the prevailing wage or the 5,000 or the 125,000. There's so many of them out there, and we generally support indexing them just to try and keep things going. However, speaking to this process and that second part, we are aware that there's a substantial portion of folks out there who are opposed to this concept.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, we didn't really want to try and bring this into this process for fear that issue would blow up the whole issue and not allow us to go forward with all the good things we'd like to do with this update. We know especially on the public improvement side, there's some major opposition to indexing. And so we're not pushing it.
Thank you very much. One follow-up and I'm done, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that you don't want to create obstacles that sidetrack the lion's share of the work you're doing. It would be helpful to me as we think of what the legislature might do to supplement your work in the session, if you could actually get that information, either Mr. Petty or Mr. Nestle, when those thresholds were in place. And the other thing I would like to know is roughly what proportion of purchasing fell within that threshold when it was implemented. And here's where I'm leading.
Uh-huh. I am sure.
What would the equivalent threshold be today to cover the same proportion of purchasing? And I'm not looking for precision down to the last dollar, but if you could give us some range,
right,
so that would guide our discussions in January.
Yes, I think I understand. Back before Bill was a cub, and when 5,000 was established, it was intended to do some serious competition beyond just buying paperclips.
Mm-hmm.
And so that threshold has moved up. We can do that.
Yeah.
Representative Nolan, do you need any other?
No, if I could get that follow-up sometime after, you know, between now and January, that would be sufficient. Thank you.
Yeah.
John, thank you. Representative Barnard.
Well, just one additional comment. You know, I'm very mindful of the concern that the public has about government being responsive and accountable. On the other hand, we also get comments about administrative costs. Somewhere there's a balance, isn't there? And of course, government needs to be accountable, and of course, even these small numbers need to be accounted for. But if we can make government more efficient, we ought to be looking at that too. And I think that's perhaps where you're headed.
Yes.
Thank you.
I agree with that. I think it's useful for the committee or for the task group to hear these comments. One of the guiding principles we've talked about that we agreed to was that we wanted to empower users to be oriented to public accountability for both outcomes and adherence to policies and process set out in statute. And that really gets, I think, to your point, Representative Barnhart. This isn't about creating a process which we can be faithful to but not get anything done, or have reams of paper to demonstrate that we went to the nth degree when we made this decision to buy something that's only going to cost $5,000. That has an inherent cost in terms of lack of efficiency. So it really is about finding this balance between preserving accountability but also being accountable for efficient outcomes. And I think there's a lot of improvement that can be made in existing statute in that regard.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I might add one other point. Bill had gone through and talked about the specific methods of source selection that was identified. One of the new methods that you have heard in that is this notion of special procurements. There's a little bit of history of that. In 1977, when the ABA Model Procurement Code was developed, it wasn't in there. When they revised it a couple of years ago, that was a new addition. What they have found in that interim period of time is that the traditional methods of public sourcing, invitation to bid, request for proposal, emergency sole source, or what they had termed a limited competition, didn't always work in the marketplace. And with the advent of technology systems that really beg for a more sophisticated, different kind of process to get that acquisition done in the public's interest, it was necessary to create a way of designing a procurement process that could achieve effective outcomes. And the special procurement section has some pretty high thresholds for deploying it, but it really allows a public agency to craft a process that's designed to reach the kind of outcome that's necessary. So it gives us some flexibility to do different kinds of things that we weren't doing 15 or 20 years ago, like system technology acquisitions in a different way. And that's what that's intended to do. And frankly, we believe that that can improve in terms of outcomes and in terms of accountability for better outcomes. We did have a session, one of the representatives on the task group, Steve Hill from IBM, had talked about a different method of buying procurement called the benefits-driven procurement, which is being kind of pioneered in Canada. So we had a session where we had an individual from a Canadian governmental entity actually over the telephone walk us through a PowerPoint presentation where we looked at this benefits-driven procurement, a procurement process that probably wouldn't fit very well under an invitation to bid or competitive seal proposal, but is the kind of thing that as responsible public procurement officials we ought to be looking at, because it's the kind of thing that can work in the marketplace, preserve accountability. So we think that special procurements will give us that kind of ability to design those sorts of procurements.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if it's your preference, I'd just like to walk you through perhaps the competitive seal bidding program and see what our recipe book looks like. Yeah, it starts at page 4 of the handout. And this is a little bit of a rewrite of what's currently in ORS 279.027, which is the directions that are given to public agencies generally when they issue invitations to bid. But as I indicated earlier, that is very much drafted toward the public improvement area, so we've revised this one to address goods and services. It starts out by stating that unless you have an exemption, except as otherwise prohibited in ORS 279A to 279A, and what we're doing is we're leaving placeholders for when we can get the right statutory subsections in there. A contracting agency may award a public contract by competitive sealed bidding in accordance with this provision and rules adopted under 279.049. The rules adopted under 279.049 refer to the Attorney General's model public contracting rules, and we don't envision a change in that. Those are interstitial rules that guide the procedures on a sub-statutory level for letting public contracts. And under the current version of that statute, the Attorney General develops those rules in response to each legislative session's changes of the public contracting law. And then local public bodies automatically are governed by those rules and may apply them, but they have the ability by adopting their own procurement rules to opt out from under. So therefore, we always have an automatic and available system for the small districts and districts that aren't interested in doing it any differently, yet we preserve local autonomy by permitting local governments to establish their own procedures so long as they're consistent with the statute. The first issue would try to indicate what an invitation to bid will contain, which includes some of the basics, the time and date by which the bids must be received, the place to submit them, and we allow in the sole discretion of the contracting agency new authority to direct or permit the submission and receipt of bids by electronic means, which is just a recognition of the new technology. Somewhat of a new provision, we wanted somebody that folks out there in the contractor community could get a hold of with respect to any particular procurement. You need somebody to talk to on these sometime. So at the suggestion of a number of members in the full committee, we added the name and the title of the person designated for the receipt of bids and the name and title of the contracting agency's contact person for the procurement, if different. We don't want people to be forced to play the telephone tag game. Third, we require a procurement description, and that's a specially defined term at the front of the provision that basically means all of the specifications, the nuts and bolts, that tell the potential contractors what they're bidding on. Third, we have a time, place, and date that pre-qualification applications must be filed, and that relates to situations in which you want to be sure that you're dealing only with the qualified bidders that have experience in this kind of an area. It's a valuable situation in limited circumstances, but we thought we'd put it in, and it also matches up with pre-qualification provisions that we have later in the article and with pre-qualification provisions that incidentally we have in the current law. Third, a very important issue, and that is a statement that the contracting agency may cancel the procurement or reject any or all bids in accordance with Section 3-301. This is an important escape hatch when we have either bids that come in well above what the agency can afford, and sometimes you just have a bad procurement. We've made a mistake in the specifications and people are bidding on the wrong thing or have misunderstood them, and sometimes it is time to pull that back and start over again. It's critical to allow an agency to stop the process rather than by offering an ITB being confronted with the legal argument that no, your ITB was an offer, we accepted it by filing a bid, you're stuck with the contract even though there's a mistake in it. That's a feature that's in the current law right now. We also require, and this is in the current law, a statement that tells a contractor or its subcontractors whether or not they have to have an asbestos abatement license in order to do the work that's being bid. And that's significant even in a goods and services contract because we do have those emergency work and minor maintenance that sometimes we can break into friable asbestos. Then we have also to advertise all the contract terms and conditions that are applicable to the procurement so they know what the deal is that they're bidding on. The subsection 3, we permit bid security in this situation, just like they do in the public improvement area. And that means that if a bidder thinks that they have left too much money on the table, they cannot pull out of the bid without forfeiting the bid security, and therefore protects the integrity of the process, because otherwise it would place the control of who gets the contract in the hands of the low bidder. They could take it or leave it. Public notice is important. We need to advertise these to make sure that the contracting community is aware of contracting opportunities. We allow this in somewhat different ways than the current law. On the top of page 6, subsection B, we state that public notice shall include publication in at least one newspaper of general circulation in the area where the contract is to be performed. That reflects current law for bids. We also allow, as an alternative, publication through an electronic medium determined by rule adopted under ORS 279.049 to reasonably provide prospective bidders or proposers notice of the solicitation. The idea here is the Attorney General's model rules will tell us the minimum reach and efforts that have to be made electronically, and then if advertisement is done by that means, then the only way somebody can complain that it hasn't been done right is by attacking the rule itself, saying it's insufficient to take care of adequate publication. And we're going to rely on the Administrative Procedures Act and public comment that we will get from interested parties to try to put together a rule that makes sure that electronic media are broadcast sufficiently to hit all the potential vendors. And because of the breadth of the rulemaking authority, we may have to have special sections of contracts to make sure that we don't leave out those people that don't have fax machines and don't have a computerized system to protect emerging businesses, things like that. All of these things have been bandied about in both the drafting committee, the sole source selection committee, and finally in the full committee. And finally, we also allow, not as an alternative, but in addition to those two modes of publication, any other supplemental medium reasonably calculated to reach prospective bidders and proposers. So this gives public agencies a lot of flexibility, but it does state a minimum, and then it lets them do a little bit more if they think that would be helpful.